Stephen Hoff's press materials for Kid Quixote say immigration and education are always major issues, particularly in an election year. But what if we took a step back and examined them in a whole new way? In Kid Quixote's, a group of students, their teacher, and the one-room school where everything is possible, author and educator Stephen Hoff explains how the children of undocumented immigrants found their voices and now speak truth by collectively translating Don Quixote, the 400-year-old Spanish tale, a story about a traveling dreamer who never gives up. First, they translated it into English and then into a bilingual musical based on their lives. And as the kids perform their work, they deliver a message of diversity, love, hope, and resilience essential to us all, painting a picture of what education in America could and perhaps should be. Stephen Hoff notes, I was inspired to write this book because I wanted to participate in a national conversation about education reform. I hope readers will appreciate the genius of children and the brilliance and generosity of spirit that these specific children, the sons and daughters of immigrants, are offering to this country. Kid Quixote's, a group of students, their teacher, and the one-room school where everything is possible is by Stephen Hoff. And normally I would need to write an introduction that says even more specifically what this book is, but I don't have to. Stephen Hoff is the chief of Still Waters in a Storm, a one-room school located in the Bushwick section on Brooklyn, New York. He has taught English, Latin, mathematics, and theater for 20 years at high schools, middle schools, and colleges in New York City, Vermont, and Canada. At Bushwick High School in Brooklyn, he co-founded Real People Theater with his students. The company received great acclaim in the worlds of education and theater and toured North America and Europe. The Village Voice called RFT nothing less than a revolution. Stephen has spoken at a number of pedagogical conferences and designed curriculum for the CUNY Gear Up Program, Youth Communication, and the Center for Social and Emotional Education. Thank you, Stephen Hoff, for being here at TKO. And in full disclosure, Stephen, before you even begin, and the reason why I have to say normally I would have to write an introduction, but that your introduction and your press material is so appropriate and spot on is that I am a colleague of yours who's done the same work for 30 years, and your story in this way touches the heart of why we do the work for populations of students. And so I thank you from the top for your work and your walk.
Well, thank you, and thank you for having me.
Most definitely, most definitely. So let us get into a lot of the circles that this story is. First, tell me a little bit about your story of being an artist educator and how you got to Bushwick, Brooklyn, and even before we get into what Stillwaters really is.
Well, I had been working in theater. I got my master's at Yale in theater studies. And then what I'd been doing after that was directing plays in downtown Manhattan and writing for magazines and newspapers about theater. But after a while, I felt like I wasn't as useful as I could be. I wanted to be able to truly belong to the communities around me. And so I read a book called Amazing Grace, which was by Jonathan Kozol, a great educator and writer.
Mm-hmm.
And I was amazed at the conditions that kids were living in. It was a story, a nonfiction story about school children in the Bronx. Mm-hmm. And I had been raised in a very sheltered way and had no idea what people were going through in the same city where I was living. So it made me really angry. And I wanted to do something about it, so I thought, let me take my fancy education to a neighborhood where nobody else wants to go and see if I can be useful. So I interviewed there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I interviewed in all five boroughs of New York and then finally chose Bushwick High School because among all those schools, it was the most needy.
And so you spent a significant period of time teaching as a classroom teacher in
That's
Bushwick.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And so,
right.
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, yes, I taught English there for 7 years. And then at the end of that period of teaching, I broke down. I had a major breakdown and was diagnosed with bipolar depression. But I didn't want to stop teaching. You know, I loved teaching, eventually I invited my former students to come over to my home and write and listen to each other, read out loud, and talk about our writing. And it became so popular that we had to move out of there, and the local pizzeria hosted us in their party room. and then the teenagers and the college students started bringing their little brothers and sisters, or some of them had children of their own, cousins, and soon the pizzeria wasn't big enough for us, so we had to find a space in the neighborhood that we could rent as a dedicated classroom. So it all started because I couldn't continue in the public school system, and then when I came back, I needed a situation that was safe for me, mentally, emotionally safe, as well as the kids. So.
Right, and that became Still Waters in the Storm, yes?
That's right. At first, we didn't have a name for the group. You know, we just had these meetings on Saturday afternoons, and we ate pizza, and we would read and write. But then one day, one of my old high school students, said that we needed to come up with a name. So he made a list of all kinds of possibilities and showed it to me. And one of them was Smooth Waters in a Storm. And so I said, I think that's beautiful. And if we change smooth to still, then we get that expression about still waters run deep. You know, that becomes part of the name. And then I asked him, why did he think of that? Why did he think of that as a name? And he said, because this place was his only place of peace in a very stormy life.
Mm-hmm.
In what is I would call a stormy, volatile neighborhood. So he and all the people who gathered felt safe wherever we were together, and so that's how we came up with the name.
Shelter in place during this global pandemic of COVID-19, we're all operating in safe distance from home studios. And Stephen, do I have you back?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay. Yes, I'm working from my dining room table, and mm-hmm. as you know, the fun of being able to stay safe in this time is always a challenge. But we were getting into the origins of what would then become the Kid Quixote's project within the little school, right? That became that you referenced in the book, which is Stillwater. And I want to kind of get into it because I think people don't understand the challenges of working in the public school system. And we talk about them, but the literal stressors that happen on, you know, teachers that then have them have to, you know, we all have to kind of then decide how we kind of recenter ourselves and then how our commitment is going to manifest. Can you tell us a little bit about, like, literally what became that challenge that then manifested in just getting students together to do basic work that informed their own identities and learning?
Sure.
Before we go into a little bit of what, you know, the students put together that's in the book, the song, and literally the writing that you had.
Sure. So when I was teaching at Bushwick High School, the class sizes were impossible. There was myself, one teacher, and as many as 30 students, and I had 5 classes a day, 5 days a week, and this is typical of all the teachers. And so I was responsible for educating and caring for 150 kids every day, and that's just impossible. There's sort of a myth of the great teacher. If you put the great teacher in a room with any number of kids, everything will be okay, but it's just not so, especially with adolescents who have profound emotional needs. So the class size was challenge number one. And then the second was that we're dealing with a lot of pressure, and in my opinion, the pressure wasn't so helpful to anyone. And it was attached to test scores. Standardized testing was evaluating not only the children, but the teachers. So if my students got good test scores, then it meant that I was a good teacher, and then, you know, I could keep my job, I could get a raise possibly. So, and then other people were effectively punished if their kids did not perform well on the tests. And the problem with the tests was they had really basically nothing to do with the lives that the kids were living. Which is not to say that you can't, kids can't learn about things that aren't part of their immediate life. But there was no attempt made to relate what was going on to their personal lives. In fact, writing about their personal feelings and experiences was forbidden. So if you took the English test to graduate high school, you were to write 4 essays. But if in any of the essays you refer to your own life, your experiences, your thoughts and feelings, then you are docked points. You're disqualified. Mm-hmm. So that was the other thing. So class size is impossible. It's impossible to care for all these kids. And then they're disallowed personal writing. And then the testing is high stakes. So everybody's on edge. And then you've just got overcrowding as well. So, you know, you put a lot of people in a room where they don't want to be, and that's a recipe for conflict and unrest. So those were some basic challenges that I dealt with, and I did everything I could. For example, I told them that we could correspond. I said, well, you write to me. If there's something you wanted to say in class but you didn't get to say it, then you can write a letter to me and tell me what you want to say, and I'll write back to you, and it'll be private. And this way, anything that's on your mind, you know, how you're feeling in class or something's going on outside of class that's bothering you, you can let me know. Because it was impossible for me, one adult, to care for all these teenagers at once. So, you know, that was a lot of work to take home all of their journals and write back to them every night. Mm-hmm. But you know, I had to do whatever I could to make the experience meaningful for them. So those are the main obstacles. And then also you're dealing with a neighborhood that is suffering from serious poverty. You know, the kids themselves referred to it as the ghetto. And poverty is a kind of violence, you know. It's a kind of daily, violence that's sort of the baseline of their lives. And it's very hard to find the peace you need to think when you're dealing with academic pressure, street pressure, you know, cultural segregation, and poverty. So, you know, being impatient with kids who are in this situation just doesn't do any good. It just inflames everybody's dissatisfactions and disappointments.
And so you found through your own challenges and ultimate breakdown space to align and maybe even identify with those folk in those communities, much less the students?
Yeah, you know, and I'm glad you said space, because one of the virtues I always preach to my students is patience. Mm-hmm. And usually we think of patience as waiting until we get what we want. You know, if my children are demanding something at home and I say, be patient, it means to them, okay, I'll just hang out in this state of tension until I get what I want. But, you know, if you look at the origin of the word patient in Latin, it actually means to allow, and which I also translate as making room. So you make room for what is. And so in making room for the kids and asking them to make room for me, we in the classroom have this sense of belonging that aligns us, because both the mentally ill and the undocumented are afraid to reveal who they really are. So, you know, the undocumented are always looking for a refuge or a sanctuary, And so are the mentally ill. So in that sense, yes, I align with the community as somebody who needs a refuge or a sanctuary and needs a sense of belonging and safety where I work.
Yeah, I was struck as I read the book and definitely having like comparable experience of the fact that you did what a lot of us have done and, you know, I really always counsel as being a no-no. You really opened up your home for the beginning of this work that became, you know, a very, you know, ongoing dynamic community-centered organization and program. And it seemed that sanctuary was very important. How did that ground itself for what would become not only this project, but the Stillwater program, which we should probably talk about and explain
sure.
a little more?
You want me to describe what we do in the
up
program?
Up to you. It's up to you.
Okay. Well, when we meet for a regular Stillwaters in a Storm gathering, it kind of it has been influenced by what Alcoholics Anonymous does. Years ago, a high school student of mine who was a brilliant poet was also an alcoholic, and she would have blackouts and violent episodes. She got in fights with police, and then when she wasn't drinking, she was a brilliant poet. Well, in an attempt to help her, I took her to her first AA meeting. And I was really moved because all the people were doing there was telling a their stories. You know, they would take turns. Each person would say what they had to say, and everybody else would thank them, and nobody would like criticize them. Or, you know, it was a safe place to share stories. And in my experience in psychotherapy, talk therapy, that process is also a sharing of stories, and the power of listening is what changed my life in therapy. The idea that someone was dedicated to listening to me and helping me understand my own story. So that's what those two experiences combined and made me believe that that's the heart of education right there, is this idea of reciprocal listening, a conversation. And eventually, over time, in practicing this at Stillwaters, in just writing something, everyone in the group would write something. Then they'd take turns reading what they wrote out loud, and everyone else would listen to them. And then they might ask questions, gentle questions, to better understand the story. But then it would be the next person's turn. And there was something very reassuring and peaceful about that practice. Like, everybody felt understood by each other. That was the goal. Not to criticize, not to compete, like school so often does, makes kids compete with each other. Here, the job and the goal was to try to understand through mutual listening.
Mm-hmm.
So... yeah, I hope, does that answer what you were asking?
No, it totally does. And I guess, you know, I was wanting you to tell a little bit about the origins of Stillwater and the sanctuary idea, because again, you know, when practitioners and teachers offer their own spaces as sanctuary, that tends to be risky, you know, or be perceived as being risky as well. I thought it was very interesting that it was the necessary step for you to bridge your own personal experience, but also to like connect with this community of brown students who definitely were having problems with their own educational and personal development.
Yeah.
And so you made that risk for yourself and for them.
Yeah, that's true. Because one of the first things that they told me when I was hired to teach at the high school was, well, they said, don't touch the students and don't be alone with them.
Mm-hmm.
If a student comes to see you in the classroom, you must leave the classroom door open to the hallway. These were really strict and urgent warnings because, some very serious crimes had been committed, crimes of abuse against children. And so they're urging teachers to protect themselves and protect the students by keeping everything transparent. So those kids came to my apartment, and then the feeling was just one of mutual trust. We had established that in the classroom at the high school, and they and their families knew me by then.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then there were people of all ages. From the beginning, we had, you know, little kids like a six-year-old girl, and then folks in their 20s, and teachers, like veteran teachers. All kinds of people would show up to these gatherings. So we were sequestered away from the street in my apartment, but we were, the group was in a safe situation from our history together, and also from the range of ages that were present. And then, you know, it was a matter of space moving over to the pizzeria, but there, that was a public venue. So again, you know, the kids were able to shelter in my home, and then they were given a special shelter at this business around the corner, the pizzeria. So even though those places were somewhat private, they felt safe to everyone involved.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. In the next minute and a half that we have for this segment, I'd like to talk about then what then actually that grouping like blew up, and by a great gift of a colleague of yours who had some resources, you all moved to a storefront, and kind of the origins of the Quixote Project came. What's so important about Quixote as a way to reach students and undocumented students' experience? In about a minute, and we'll get into it in the next segment as well.
Okay. So for now, you want me to talk about the
sure.
classroom that we established?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So we found this space. It was apparently it was supposed to be a medical lab, but the deal fell through. And we were, thanks to friends of mine who were TV stars at the time, we were able to put down a deposit and rent this space and also have it renovated. Here is the key. There used to be only three skinny windows that didn't open. And so I had a huge window installed, cut into the front wall. And it's a storefront, so we are right there on the sidewalk. So everyone walking by can see what's going on inside, and we never lose sight of the neighborhood that is our home. And that means sometimes people just walk in and ask what's going on, and happens all the time. But that's what we wanted. We wanted to be in the neighborhood, present, and be visible. And then that's how word traveled, as parents came by and saw children reading and writing and asked, what's going on in here? And when I told them, they said, well, can my kids come? And I just kept saying yes.
So, Stephen, we're right at the point where the Quixote Project is starting to kind of bloom. What made you decide to translate Don Quixote, and how does it connect to the children of the undocumented and their experience in Bushwick, Brooklyn?
Well, I wanted to do a translation project because my relationship with the kids and their families is often one of translation. They are native Spanish speakers, and I came to the neighborhood knowing no Spanish. So, and now I can carry on conversations thanks to them, their patience with me. So I wanted to design a project that we could work on together that really represented the common ground among us, between us. And even though I come from a very different background, very different culture, that there still is common ground in this great story. And the reason for that is that, a couple of reasons. One is Don Quixote, the character, is an idealist. He believes in values that seem to have gone out of fashion. And he thinks his purpose in life is to rescue other people and defend the defenseless. So I felt like, well, I have a bit of that sort of crazy impulse in me. And then the kids, when you take an old man like Quixote, who may or may not be crazy, and then you turn that character into a kid, like in our case, a 7-year-old girl, then crazy turns into idealistic and imaginative. Mm. So when it's an old man putting on homemade armor and riding out and trying to battle and rescue people, it's funny, it's sometimes inspiring, but it's also sad. And he ends up on the ground, beaten up again and again for his efforts. But as I say, if it's a kid telling the story and a kid acting out that part, then there's something really uplifting about it because they're too young to have given up yet. Mm. And so they, and kids love a sense of adventure. And that's what, that's Quixote is a road adventure. That's what the whole story is, one adventure after another. And so I thought, well, let's not only translate this and discuss our word choices together, but let's turn it into theater. So I was returning to my training, my professional background. And I thought, we need to travel around and show people this, show children, idealistic, imaginative children being brave. So the story itself had a parallel in the real-life process of making and performing this show.
Mm-hmm. And we have a clip of a short clip of one of the songs, and you have some prep that you would like to do. It's is this the rescue song?
Yeah,
I think that we have. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so this is the first song that the group wrote. The rescuing song is based on a scene in the novel where Quixote tries to save a young shepherd boy who is being whipped by his cruel boss. And at the very moment where the boss tells the boy to shut his mouth and stop crying at this beating, the kids decided that's exactly where the boy, the shepherd, needs to sing as a powerful gesture to say, you know, I need you to listen to me. I'm suffering, and I want you to hear my voice, please, and care for me. So that's the inspiration for the song. And it took us a good, I'd say, 5 months to write this collectively with everyone working on all the lyrics and the music. And so I think that sets it up.
Greg, and just so everyone knows, right, Stillwater is a homework prep. So the students are coming after school. They're doing their homework. They're getting food. And then they're jumping into first translating and then making this musical.
That's right.
So,
yeah.
Yes. So I think we have the clip. Can we play that clip, Maddie? I'm always struck when I read, when I read the section in the book and read the lyrics of the desire to help, even though it could be said that these students are in dire circumstances and need to help themselves, especially given the immigration challenge and parents who are literally at risk of being deported.
And that's the way the kids are. They always want to help. And, you know, that. And they're up against impossible forces, but they don't quit. They want to do whatever they can to help other people. And, you know, they're living in poverty, but they're forever feeding me. They bring food to me. You know, so it's the spirit that they have. And they and their parents who come here, you know, out of desperation, trying to avoid violence and awful poverty back in their home country. And then they find themselves abused by political, violent political rhetoric. And then, nonetheless, their spirit is, their desire is to offer something beautiful. And that's what they keep doing. And that's what they do for me. They lift up my heart every time I'm with them. And I just want to say one thing about immigration, if I may.
Sure.
That in the practice we have of listening to each other's stories, I've found that what I think might be the cure for the animosity directed at immigrants, and that's if you get to know a real person, you know, get to know their story, and then they get to know your story, it becomes impossible to see them as just part of a group, a type of people, you know? I guess you can't make general statements about this type of person once you know the actual person, really know them. And that requires patience and humility and trust among everybody in the room. But that's a big reason why I wrote the book, too, was to let people get to know these kids. And I believe once they know them, it's impossible to turn them away.
Well, I think that's a beautiful point, and it's the desire also to, like, come into the circle, as we say, right? I love the idea, and it's such a great and galvanizing kernel of the practice of doing this work is that you come into a circle, and it equalizes all the space because everyone, as you said in the book, and I love, you know, and it resonated so strongly with me, is like there is no stage space. You sit on the floor, and everyone is on the floor together, and even if they're out on the outskirts of the circle, depending on your space, everyone has to have the desire to sit in space together and listen to each other. And it's the great equalizer.
Yes, and we consider ourselves partners in conversation. You know, oftentimes in school, teachers feel the pressure to control the room because, you know, there's a phrase, classroom management. Mm-hmm. And that's a big deal, at least it was at the school where I taught. And I found that once I surrendered that control to the group, that it wasn't a problem anymore. You know, that the kids I wasn't trying to impose something on them. There was this mutual listening that turned it into a cooperative room. So there, control wasn't that issue. And sometimes teachers also feel this pressure to know a lot more than their students and never to make a mistake when they're teaching, never let them know you don't know something. But I found once I started admitting that I didn't know, that's when the class came together.
Right.
I took away the issues of authority and turned that into a shared authority. So that's something I wish I could say to teachers and administrators and politicians is that there, if you model these gatherings, classroom gatherings, on what I understand of the Stone Age tribe, you know, it's like an extended family where everybody is taking care of everyone else. The big ones are looking out for the little ones, and the little ones are so playful, they lift up the big ones. And, you know, the old saying about it takes a village. Well, I found the big change for me when I started Stillwaters was having all the ages of kids together, plus adolescents, college students, adults, even senior citizens. So having the full range of ages present, I felt replicated this Stone Age tribe or small village. And everybody just calms down as soon as you got that population together, that variety of people, everyone calms down.
Yes, and it always is a connection to, depending on the community and the culture, what those communities and culture know as their cultural and norms and learning norms that happen when they come outside of the schools. To have inter-age, you know, engagement in learning is probably the first line of how those students learn in their communities and in their homes. And I know I had a comparable experience. There's nothing like getting all ages in a room and seeing how the care happens, especially when you have a goal, a project goal, which leads me to the specific task that was, let's say this again, the translation of Don Quixote, which is a huge novel and an old novel in another language. Yes. That you all literally translated. And can you tell again the ages of the students in Stillwater and the process of the translation even before writing the musical, or was it the same? And it should be also said that your book details this process, but also interweaves your own walk with getting some centrality over your own challenges. So how did that all weave together?
Well, this is another element that I would propose for education reform, and that's to design a project that allows a number of people of different ages and different abilities to make contributions, meaningful contributions, to accomplishing their goals. So instead of just kids going home and doing homework based on a lesson that they learned in class, there would be this ongoing project that all of them would be part of. And in that situation, a 5-year-old would have as much to say as a 17-year-old, although they might say they will have different points of view and varying life experiences. But putting them together in the room over a project, instead of laying out a curriculum for them, because a curriculum is a path that someone else has laid out, and then your job is to walk that path. But if you depart from that idea of curriculum and turn it into project, and especially a project that can in some way benefit the neighborhood that they live in, so that school is not removing them from the life of the community, but actually serving the life of the community, I think then they have intrinsic motivation to do it and do it well. So in our case, that's a theater project.
And thank you. I so want to thank you for your work. And I have to stop you because we've run out of time and the technical difficulties kind of got us off track. I just want to thank you for your work and wish you continued success, Stephen. Good to speak with you.
Well, thank you. This has been a great pleasure, and I hope we get to meet someday.
Most definitely. And me as well.